I'm Artie Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The Mueller report concluded that Russia had interfered with the 2016 election to try to benefit Donald Trump. And while there were no conspiracy charges against the Trump campaign, there was plenty of evidence of meetings and contacts with Russians, including one at Trump Tower offering dirt on Hillary Clinton. ABC's George Stephanopoulos interviewed President Trump at the White House this week about what he would do this time if approached.
Your campaign this time around, if foreigners, if Russia, if China, if someone else offers you information on an opponent, should they accept it or should they call the FBI?
I think maybe you do both. I think you might want to listen. There's nothing wrong with listening. If somebody called from a country, Norway, we have information on your opponent. Oh. I think I'd want to hear it.
You want that kind of interference in our elections?
It's not an interference. They have information. I think I'd take it. If I thought there was something wrong, I'd go maybe to the FBI. If I thought there was something wrong.
Federal Election Commission Chairwoman Ellen Weintraub said she wanted to make something perfectly clear, quote, "It is illegal for any person to solicit, accept, or receive anything of value from a foreign national in connection with a U.S. election. This is not a novel concept." George Washington warned hundreds of years ago about the insidious wiles of foreign influence. We asked Tom Nichols to join us. He's a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College, also an adjunct at the U.S. Air Force School of Strategic Force Studies and the Harvard Extension School, author of a book called The Death of Expertise. He does not speak for the government. Tom Nichols, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to join you.
So if you were a member of the Norwegian government, what message was the president sending you?
Well, first, it's interesting how often he picks Norway, which is a strange thing in and of itself. But I think the message to a member of any government is the White House is open for business. If you have something to say, if you're a foreign intelligence service, the White House is willing to listen. And I think this is immensely destructive. I think it's an appalling thing for a president to say. And it's also, I think, important to remind people that anybody in the federal government who has a security clearance, if they're approached by a foreign government, they're required to report that contact to their security personnel. It's not optional. It's not. There's no if it's bad exception. There's no room for a judgment call. If you're approached by someone who says, "I have information that I want to give you," you don't get to make a call about whether or not to call the FBI or your security representative in your organization. I mean, this is really a bad message in so many directions, whether it's to Norway or to Russia or, to anybody who is walking around with a security clearance. It's crazy.
Is it any different from what he said, Donald Trump said during the campaign, "Russia, if you're listening, to find the 30,000 missing emails of Hillary Clinton"?
No, and I think it's interesting that his supporters say that he's not soliciting anything. During the campaign, when he was a private citizen, he can say whatever he wants, and really that's, just our judgment about whether that's right or wrong as a private citizen. But he's the president of the United States. And when he says, if a foreign government would like to come to me with dirt on a United States citizen who is running against me in a way that will help me personally, I think that puts it completely in a different light, because I think that is soliciting help from foreign governments. The other thing I think got lost in all of this is that foreign governments may well want to approach American campaigns, not just the president, but other campaigns, with information that's false as a way of contaminating or poisoning our political process, which is, of course, what happened in 2016. So this notion that, I'd take a look at it, and if it were bad, I'd say something. There's really an immense amount of arrogance in that, on the assumption that you would know whether something is good or bad, or whether you were being fooled or having an operation run against you. It's aside from being an appalling thing to say, it's an incredibly dangerous thing to say.
Well, and I would think that that governments operate in their own self-interest. So it's not out of a generosity of spirit that you would be helping someone running for president in the United States. You'd be doing it for your own self-interest.
Well, I think it says a lot about Donald Trump's worldview that he thinks that other governments would come to him because they think he's a swell guy. And that they would say, you seem like a good president and we really want to help you out here. And we're doing this out of the goodness of our hearts because we Norwegians really care about the Republican Party. You know, this is, again, just a the president has often been described as having a narcissistic worldview. I think this is a classic example of the president not understanding that other governments might have interests besides his well-being. I think that's another thing that makes it so dangerous.
One of the other things he said by way of explanation was, I talk to world leaders all the time. I have tea with the Queen of England. How does that fit? How does that sit with you?
I have often thought that the president does not, coming from the world of business, he does not understand the world of foreign affairs diplomacy, and clearly in 2 years he hasn't learned anything about it. I don't know if he really believes what he said, but just to clarify, there is an immense difference between a formal, recorded diplomatic meeting with a foreign head of state or a foreign head of government and someone from the intelligence community or from a private entity that may be associated with some pretty unsavory elements coming forward and saying, we would like to inject this into the government of the United States as information. And I think that's, again, it's incredibly dangerous. And the president seems to have walked it back. But I think with President Trump, you always have to start from the assumption that the first thing he says is the truth and the rest of it is damage control.
Let me try another argument on you. And this is an argument saying, well, look at the Democratic National Committee. Look at the Clinton campaign. They hired Fusion GPS, who hired former British spy Christopher Steele to come up and do opposition research. He's obviously a foreigner. I should add that Christopher Steele, once he saw things that troubled him, he did go to the FBI. Maybe that is the difference. But do you see a difference there?
I see an immense difference. First of all, I think hiring opposition firms, the president's right about this. People do opposition research all the time. That's different than going to agents of a foreign government or letting agents of a foreign government approach you and say, we as a government have some information that we'd like to pass to you to influence your election. This was a retired foreign spy of an allied country. And I think we also have to make some distinctions here as well, saying, look, I was hired to do some research in Europe, which is, retracing this global billionaire's steps. And I found some scary things. And so I'm alerting your law enforcement people and they can do with it what they will. That's quite different than saying I'm going to go to the president of the United States as an emissary of a hostile foreign power and give you information meant to for you to use against another American citizen. I think I know the president's supporters have tried to conflate those, but I think most of them know better.
Is information the same thing as money, for instance? And there are more specific laws, I would say, about you cannot accept money from a foreign government, as Weintraub said, if you're running for election. Is information the same as money in your book?
Well, the law is very clear. It's a thing of value. It's not just money. The federal election requirements are that you cannot accept a thing of value. And that includes information. That includes anything that would be valuable to you as a campaign. If the regulations had meant just money, they would have said money. But actually, you're not allowed. There's a whole bunch of things. Mm-hmm. And again, one of the things that I find so distressing is that we're thinking about having to write this into law. You shouldn't have to write a law to tell people to be patriotic Americans. That should be something you do as a natural inclination as a citizen of the United States. You shouldn't have to do it because somebody wrote it down and told you that you shouldn't be accepting valuable information that may or may not be true from agents of a hostile foreign government.
But that's the situation we're in. I mean, doesn't that not mean that we need some kind of a law so there is no confusion going forward?
I think it says something about the Trump campaign, but I think it says something terrible about us as a people. I think the fact that so many people are willing to defend this behavior or to wave it away or to make explanations for it because it happens to be politically convenient to them at this moment tells you something about where our political culture has fallen. And I think this is damage that it's going to take quite a long time to recover in our democracy. I think that this is not a healthy moment for us, and I don't think it's going to get better anytime soon.
Let me ask you something else, and this is, I'm going to quote from CNN here. President Donald Trump said he would not have allowed the CIA to recruit the half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, quote, under my auspice. Trump wouldn't confirm or deny reports that Kim Jong-nam had been working with the CIA prior to being killed in Malaysia in 2017, saying he didn't know anything about it. Quote, I know this, that the relationship is such that that wouldn't have happened under my auspices, and I don't know about that. Nobody knows. He's saying that as president, he would not allow the CIA to investigate or use someone as a spy on North Korea.
I am baffled as to why he felt the need to say this, other than that he still believes he has some kind of personal relationship. This goes back to our earlier discussion about how the president views the world, where he thinks other foreign leaders have great affection for him and they really have his best interests at heart because he views the world that way. Presidents in general, when it comes to these kinds of operations, are very circumspect about saying anything at all. And I don't understand, I suppose I do, but I think it's incredibly unwise to talk about what you would or wouldn't do in terms of recruiting foreign agents. I think if a highly placed member of the North Korean family came to any Western intelligence service and said, I want to cooperate with you, I want to give you information, there's a case of all the times when the president said, I'd have to take a look at it, that might be the time you should say it. But the wisest thing is not to say anything at all.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye to you, Tom. So this is the kind of controversy or scandal, whatever you want to call it, du jour. Are we just going to sort of move on and forget this ever happened?
I hope we don't, but unfortunately, I think the White House strategy is that they will throw a bigger grenade into the pool in a couple of days that will make us focus on that moment, and we may well just end up moving on it. I think this is really one of the most shocking things I've ever seen.
Really?
In American politics, but the president has a unique talent for overcoming his scandals by creating new ones. So it's quite possible that this will get lost in the scrum again.
Well, Tom Nichols, thanks for joining us once again on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Professor of National Security Affairs at the U.S. Naval War College, wrote a book called The Death of Expertise. And again, he does not speak for the government, speaking about what President Trump told George Stephanopoulos earlier this week. After this very short break, we're going to shift gears and talk about how to handle conflicts and arguments and how to fight fair. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Well, there are many ways to handle conflicts and disagreements. You can engage in a screaming match and blame the other person. You could use the silent treatment. You can pretend that nothing is wrong. You can play head games and be passive aggressive. You can also cool off, listen to the other person, have a civil conversation about what's wrong and what to do about it. Not so easy, huh? You cannot have a relationship, whether at home, with friends, at work, without having a disagreement or an argument. That's just human nature. The trick is how to resolve the problem and preserve the relationship. We asked clinical psychologist Daphne DeMarneff and organizational psychologist Leanne Davey to join us. DeMarneff is the author of a book called The Rough Patch, Marriage and the Art of Living Together, also Maternal Desire on Children, Love, and the Inner Life, joining us by telephone. Daphne, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And joining us from the CBC in Toronto, Leanne Davey. She wrote a book called The Good Fight, Use Productive Conflict to Get Your Team and Organization Back on Track. Leanne Davey, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks. It's great to be here, Marty.
Nice to have you with us as well. I don't know if you two know each other or whether we have brought you together for the first time, but it's interesting to look at families and also to look at work. And I wonder, Leanne, if I can toss this to you first, is work a kind of family?
It can be, and certainly it can have all the benefits and connection and sense of belonging and all of the dysfunction. So, you know, for many of us, we spend a lot more time with our colleagues at work than we do with our families.
How do you see it, Daphne?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I'm a therapist, and I see people talk every day about their marriages or their kids or their workplace, and workplaces are often places of high drama emotionally.
Well, let's put some good stuff on the table, or some helpful stuff, I should say. And Daphne, I'll begin with you. What are some of the rules, if I can put it that way, or guidelines for fighting fair, for being a good debater or arguer? How do you see that, especially within the family?
Right. So, I mean, the problem with fights, of course, is that they're fights, and no one is skillful in a fight, right? The definition of a fight is you're not cool or in control. So part of being a healthy fighter is, in some sense, being able to kind of bracket those times when you become unskillful. Of course, you should fight fair. You know, certain things are off limits, physical threats, insults, name calling, etc. If people slip, they should try to, in some sense, put that aside and not relitigate it when they're coming back in with cooler heads to try to talk about the issue at hand. That's one thing that I think is really important.
How about to you, Leanne? I'm interested in the subtitle to your book, Productive Conflict. What does that look like at the workplace?
At the workplace, productive conflict has three characteristics. One, it gets you to the other side of the issue so that you can actually get the business moving again. Secondly, it enhances trust between you and the person that with whom you had the conflict. And third, productive conflict is a conflict where you can look yourself in the mirror at the other end and feel proud of yourself. So it's the kind of conflict that moves you forward, as opposed to some of the conflict options, which are that you move backward by yelling or some of those negative behaviors Daphne was talking about, or conflict you get stuck in where you go around in circles like passive-aggressive conflict. So we want conflict that moves you to the other side of the fight.
Are there, though, organizations that, in a sense, create conflict either by policies or practices or even by design, Leanne?
I would argue that every organization has conflict as part of just doing business. So conflict is when we have opposing needs and demands, and every organization is full of opposing needs and demands. You know, the sales force is trying to get more product, more sexy product out the door, and the, you know, the supply chain folks are trying to manage it and pace it out. That's conflict, needing to decide which work is the most important, what our priorities are. That's full of conflict. So all organizations create conflict constantly, even when they're healthy and doing what they're supposed to do, let alone all those hard things about did somebody get a higher workload than someone else.
Daphne, I'm just curious about if there are certain themes that most families get into conflict about.
Yeah, I certainly think there are. I just want to piggyback a bit on what Leanne said, because I think the same principle applies to marriage relationships and family relationships, namely that there's always going to be conflict. Right. And, you know, one of the things Leanne talks about is getting comfortable with being uncomfortable, getting comfortable with being able to be in conflict. And I often say to couples that they have a kind of illusion that if it's still waters and calm, that that's somehow the healthy relationship. And in fact, the healthy relationship is one where you can take on conflictual issues together. And of course, in marriages, they're big ones. You know, kids are huge, money is huge, sex can be huge. Those, I would say, are the big three.
Are the big three. And in terms of dealing with that, as you said, having, I guess, a sense of goodwill that your partner at least, you know, is committed to the relationship, even if you might disagree about some of the details of it, seems to me, Daphne, that's got to be so critical.
It's huge, and that has to do with emotional security. And we don't have complete control over how emotionally secure we are. That can come from our families. That can come from our early relationships. What we want in an intimate relationship is to feel loved and lovable. And so you can understand why even, you know, why didn't you lower the toilet seat or whatever, if you're emotionally insecure and vulnerable, can become, you know, an issue of emotional survival. And a lot of the things that become fraught in intimate relationships are symbolic. There are things that basically one person feels the other's communicating, you're not a lovable person, and I'm going to reject you, I'm going to abandon you, and it gets much more fraught than it needs to. So what you're saying about trying to disentangle that fear from the issue at hand can be extraordinarily powerful in helping people to actually solve problems.
In fact, Leanne, you have said, looking at the workplace, that feelings are really more important than facts.
Yeah. So unfortunately, the way humans work is we make decisions emotionally, and then we collect the facts and data that make us feel good about how we feel. So if we try and have a conflict with somebody by fighting with them about their facts, we're just fighting with that facade that they're building. And in fact, we won't get to the other end of the conflict. So we need to understand what's going on beneath that. And feelings and emotions are things that are hints that there's an injury being done. It's that next layer down, what they value, what they believe, what's important to them. And if we can get to that level, then our conflicts will be shorter. We will build trust as we go through conflict with our colleagues instead of just constantly trying to rebut all these facts they're throwing at us. That tends not to be effective. If it's just about facts, you're not actually having true conflict. You're probably just problem solving.
Oh, well, that's interesting. And if we're talking about feelings, we're talking about what? Anger, feeling hurt. You know, I'm thinking, you know, the range of human feelings that we all have.
Yeah. And on teams and in organizations, they're often inwardly directed. So sometimes we feel ashamed. We feel that we're disconnected from the in-group. There's really great new research that shows when you disagree with a teammate, you have the same parts of your brain light up as if you gave an answer on a test that was wrong. So we can sometimes feel that getting feedback from our team that we've said something that they don't like makes us feel like we're on the outs, we're not included. And so that can lead to embarrassment, disconnection. So sometimes it's anger, sometimes it's frustration, but other times it's really wrapped up in our own sense that we are. So, you know, Daphne was talking about being loved. Well, on the team, it's really that we're valued, and we can get information that tells us that we're not valued, and that's very hurtful.
Daphne, let me give you a specific, it's a sort of everyday example, but let's say in a couple, one feels that they're doing all the work or the lion's share of the work, and the other person is not. How do you suggest that they discuss this in a rational way?
Well, you've hit on probably the biggest issue.
Really?
For young parents. Yeah, people who have their first baby, that is the number one point of conflict that they tend to have. And you can understand why, because roles are changing and division of labor is shifting. And the main thing that happens in that conflict or any conflict is that when you feel things are unjust or unfair, you feel victimized and you feel you're at the receiving end of someone else's bad treatment. And of course, that is the thing that escalates people's sense of insecurity and shame and et cetera. So if you can find a calm moment, speak as neutrally as possible, and try to share your reality about this without blame and criticism, that's obviously going to be your best strategy. People may have different views about what is fair, and that there has to be room for that too.
Well, I'm going to think too with young couples, they're also sleep deprived, so that doesn't help the situation.
Right. Anything that makes you more hair trigger is not going to help. And I just want to say there's huge power in self-awareness about that. We were talking a bit about shame, and shame is such a powerful reason why people can't own their own part and their own fallibility and their own imperfection. And it's your friend to be able to say, of course, I'm a fallible human being. I don't have all the answers. I'm muddling through like everybody else. But this is my experience. This is my reality. What's yours? Can we somehow come to a better solution?
And maybe using the word I or we rather than you.
Yeah, that's
with
a
that
big
finger
one.
Point.
No, of course. I mean, when I see couples, and to see how being self-aware and self-responsible is really kind of the wonder drug. You can have all the same problems as another couple, but if you can say, hey, I know my part in this, I'm trying to understand my part in this, I'm working on it, that is what the other person needs more than anything.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Daphne D. Marniff, and she's a clinical psychologist, author of a book called The Rough Patch, Marriage and the Art of Living Together. Leanne Davey with us as well. She's an organizational psychologist, author of The Good Fight, Using Productive Conflict to Get Your Team and Organization Back on Track. Looking at conflict within families, within the workplace, and we want to hear from you. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Leanne, I'm also thinking, I mean, yeah, there is a kind of hierarchy at home in that the parents are, in a sense, or should be largely in control of what's happening on the home front. But in work, we do have all these hierarchies. We have our colleagues, we've got our bosses, supervisors, you got the CEO. How does that complicate how we negotiate conflict or disagreements?
Speaking truth to power is always a challenge. So people are reticent to share feedback and share their reality with their bosses. Interestingly, though, people seem to know intuitively how to have conflict with somebody who works for them or somebody they work for. Mm-hmm. What we're seeing more and more is as we get into different organizational structures, like a matrix structure and places where you have to work across, what people are really struggling with is how do I have conflict and tension and cope with incompatible needs with my peers, mm-hmm. with people who work in different teams. So the hierarchy is one thing, but we've got this added complexity now of, well, what do I do when somebody's in a different department and I can't just tell them what to do and they can't tell me what to do? And we've got a bit of a stalemate because the normal power relationships don't hold. Then we have to, that's one of the reasons we have to be much better at conflict in modern organizations, is because there's many more situations like that.
How do you do that?
So you spend a lot of time working on understanding where they are coming from. When we get into conflict, and as Daphne was saying, when you're in that fight, it's very hard to do this. But first of all, you want to make sure that you're investing in relationships across your organization proactively. So, you know, don't wait till you're thirsty to dig a well. So when you need to build trust and relationships across, do that when all is well. And then in the moment when something starts to erupt, you'll find people give you the benefit of the doubt. So that's one really important piece. The second thing I tell people is when you get into a fight, when somebody raises an idea at work and you think it's the dumbest thing you've ever heard, The important thing is to take a breath and then ask them a question, share what you've heard, and essentially think about it this way. You want their truth to come out of your mouth before your truth does. So if you can say, okay, you think the most important thing we can do is have a big event for customers. And if that's what they've said, just paraphrase back what they've said, Ask them some questions. And then once they're nodding and they're saying, yes, that's right, then you can say, that's interesting. You know, I was thinking about the importance of spending that budget on an employee event. So this general idea, first of all, always build relationships proactively so that you get the benefit of the doubt. And secondly, when you do get into a difficult discussion or an argument or a fight about what you want to do, make their truth come out of your mouth before yours does. And then it will feel like problem solving as allies rather than fighting as adversaries.
Well, that's really interesting. Daphne, what do you think of that?
This is fascinating because it's exactly the same principle in an intimate relationship. I think it can be in some ways even more challenging because of this issue I raised earlier of emotional survival, of how deeply people feel they need to be heard and understood and recognized in intimate relationships. But the same principles absolutely apply. In other words, if you can center yourself in the position of having compassion and curiosity about the other person's reality and mirror that back to them, that will give them the experience of being understood, which then disarms them, makes them less defensive, makes them more interested and able to listen to you. And of course, there's a chicken and the egg problem. You know, in a therapy session, each person is battling to be heard. But that stance is the one that you have to work on, to be able to separate, okay, I have my own reality that I want to share, but I can really listen to this other person and hear their reality. That's the challenge. And it's a lifelong challenge, handling that skillfully.
No question about that. Definitely, let me go back to you. But I'm thinking of the avoidant person, the person who will do anything in their power to avoid conflict. Now, they may sort of, you know, sulk quietly or give someone the silent treatment, which I really think is really pernicious and harmful to the relationship. How do you deal with something like that?
Exactly. I mean, that's huge. And it gets back to what Leanne said, you know, about getting comfortable with being uncomfortable. One of the big challenges for every individual is to be able to articulate their point of view and enter into collaborative discussion, hopefully not too conflictual, right, in meshing those points of view. And that is actually one of the biggest causes of explosion, that people don't do it. You know, in other words, they bury it, they sulk, they get passive-aggressive, they withdraw, they suppress. And at some point, the truth is going to come out, right? And then it comes out in an explosion because they weren't comfortable to begin with in talking in a more neutral way about and asserting their point of view. And people learn that in families, right? I mean, all sorts of people feel like conflict was badly dealt with in their family. No one ever disagreed unless they were screaming. I mean, one of the things I try to work with people is their allergy to any kind of tension. They need to be able to tolerate conflict in order to resolve anything. But when someone is avoidant, that's often a very early pattern, and it takes work to change.
How do you see it, Leanne? We're almost up on a break here, but I'd be curious about how you see that in the workplace.
So conflict avoidance is a very, very significant problem in the workplace as well. And it's probably people who've learned it at home very early, and it's how they've been socialized, either told if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all, or all those other voices we hear in our heads. So that conflict aversion in the organization turns into what I call conflict debt. And so we have the initial issue that we're trying to avoid, but even the act of avoiding it creates this sort of compounding interest of stress and trying to avoid that person and doing inefficient workarounds and sleepless nights. And so conflict avoidance is a tremendous problem in organizations. And we see executive teams who are into severe conflict debt. We see teams that aren't dealing with some of their workplace issues and concerns. So it's a big problem, just like it is at home.
That is Leanne Davey, who joins us along with Daphne DeMarnef, and we are talking about how to handle conflicts, arguments, disagreements at work, at home, with friends, with colleagues, with family. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, talking with our guests about how to fight fair, how to be better at handling conflict in our lives, whether it's with family or friends or colleagues. Daphne DeMarnef is a clinical psychologist, author of The Rough Patch. Leanne Davey is an organizational psychologist, author of The Good Fight. And again, you can join us. Here's how to tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Daphne, let me go back to you and ask you specifically about teenagers. I was one. I raised one, and I have to say that at one point during raising our teenage son, I turned to my husband and I said, I think we're the worst family in America. I just felt like everything that we believed in was being tested to the limits. Do you have special advice for people raising teenagers?
Right. So I have raised three teenagers myself. My youngest.
So you've been there, done that, right?
Yeah, and I have to say, what I try to help my patients and my clients who are struggling with this to accept is that you are going to be it's a very thankless task, and accepting that can help you. In other words, there's a real loss for people often between the kind of satisfying affection that they experience with younger children and the sort of even idealization of them as parents and the necessary developmental step of differentiating and individuating and basically thinking you're the biggest jerk in the world. And that's a loss and that's painful. And so to help people accept the kind of inevitability of that can be helpful. But I also think that, you know, people have written about this a lot, you know, that the relationship is changing, that you're trying to help create a responsible, self-sufficient adult. And what that means is that they are going to have to take off their training wheels and start figuring out how to make decisions for themselves. And your role is changing as the kind of director of their lives to somebody who's helping them navigate their lives. And that then requires some of the same principles we're talking about, you know, a certain kind of respect for their point of view, an ability to listen, and not taking the position of I'm the authority, you have to do it my way or else. And so that a lot of these principles we're talking about, I think, come into play.
Leanne, I know we're not talking about teenagers at the workforce, but anything you want to add to that just from your perspective?
I actually have two teenage daughters
at
the moment.
There we go.
So this is very real for me. So just like in the workplace, when we're talking about teenagers, conflict has a very important role, as Daphne was alluding to. We want that tension there because that tension is what's teaching them to be individuals, creating self-sufficiency. So one of the things that I think in both home and work we have to remember is that tension is a positive and constructive thing. And if we can think of conflict as tension, where something, two things are pulling in opposite directions, but it's important that we balance them. So at home, maybe it's one, a member of a couple who likes to, you know, spend and go out to dinner and be a little frivolous and fun, and one that likes to save and be prudent. Well, those tensions are important in a marriage. Similarly, there are tensions, the tension between the HR person not wanting the operations person to work everyone to death. Those are healthy and productive tensions. And the more we can realize that tensions make us better and not experience and think about those things as friction that wears us down. And when you have a teenager, it's really hard to not feel it as friction. But to the extent that you can think, this is tension and it's supposed to be there and it's healthy, versus this is friction and it's killing me, I think that works as a mindset at both at work and in home.
Just kind of reframing it that way. One more question about children, and Daphne, I'll toss this to you. How do you feel about parents arguing in front of their children? Obviously, arguing can take so many different forms, but expressing disagreements or even revealing conflicts within the relationship.
Right. So I think on the plus side, you know, a lot of people say, I never learned how to have healthy conflict in my family. You know, either there was screaming and yelling or there was just silence and nobody fought. And so I think there is some modeling that can happen where the kids can witness two people, two individuals, both of whom care about them, who have differences of opinion, who are finding a way through that to resolve it. And the research seems to suggest that small kids generally react to resolved conflict as if there was no conflict at all. In other words, if they see their parents come back together and still be loving, then it's not as if the fight gets coded in their minds as some, you know, painful, difficult thing. That said, of course, there's, you know, ways in which people can fight that are deeply upsetting and dysregulating.
Absolutely.
To, you know, if people are screaming, I mean, this wreaks havoc on the young nervous system. And so there, you know, all the principles we're talking about how do you actually disagree, have tension, have differences, and put your heads together and come up with some kind of solution. All the healthy ways we're talking about that, I think are actually productive for kids to see.
How about, Leanne, the same idea in the workplace where there are disagreements, to handle it behind closed doors or to do it out in the open? What do you think?
We have the same experience with leaders who need to role model that conflict and tension are a productive part and a normal part of working together. And we have new research now that shows that conflict-avoidant managers create conflict-avoidant cultures, and then that conflict debt problem increases in the organization. So same thing. We want people role modeling effective conflict. One of the things I say all the time is that you're going to mess it up, and don't worry about messing it up, because the other opportunity you have is to publicly to say, that's not how I wanted to show up in that conversation. I didn't listen to how your perspective on this. I'm just going to zip it for a minute. Tell me what I wasn't hearing before, or tell me what I need to understand. So don't worry about messing it up. Don't worry about getting into a conflict. As Daphne's saying, it's about how does it resolve? And if it resolves in a constructive way, then people remember it as, we can have conflict. We can trust one another enough to know we can go through a rough patch and get to the other side. So we want leaders role modeling productive conflict, just like parents need to be.
Let me read some comments, and I'll give out the email address, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation talking about how to handle conflict and preserve relationships. An email from Dave who says, where's the line between honest conflict resolution via persuasion and manipulation? Daphne, can I toss that over to you?
That's so interesting as a question, because I, in my work, I think it's with couples at least, it's so obvious when one person's trying to manipulate the other. You know, it doesn't work as a form of persuasion. So or, you know, I mean, if I'm the therapist, I'm obviously trying to help point that out. I mean, I think we'd all agree manipulating someone isn't a good idea. I think persuasion is just a part of, you know, resolving an issue. Is if each person can kind of come forward and say, you know, this is what I really think, and these are the reasons why. You know, that seems like part of a healthy process of collaboration to me.
I mean, it seems like manipulation is about winning, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's very corrosive to trust when you're in an intimate relationship and you feel that the other person is basically just trying to get their way, that they're really not holding your best interests at heart. And you know, there's all sorts of things, toxic behaviors that people engage in intimate relationships that are, you know, destructive to the bond, and one of them is certainly manipulation.
Here's an email from Kristen. Major conflict during the 2016 election when I realized my husband was going to vote for Trump. We are in couples therapy, but I struggle more than he does about our political differences. And we've actually done shows about, you know, the politics and psychology. Leanne, I realize you work with organizations, but I'd be curious about your response to that.
Yeah, very understandable. That is a very, very difficult
And you're Canadian,
issue.
I should say, so you have a little distance on this conversation.
A little, yes, but you can imagine our news is very much full of the same thing. So one of the reasons, as we said, as I was talking earlier, it's those values beneath the surface. It's not about the facts. It's not about, you know, what Trump said or what the policy platform is. It's about how you're interpreting it and what it means to you. And so one of the things you want to do in those conflicts is not talk about what the latest tweet was, but instead talk about, this is how I interpret it. This is how it affects me. This is why I worry about it. And really have a better conversation with someone you love and care about that helps them understand how the behavior is injuring something that matters to you. If you're in the workplace, talking about politics is very dangerous, but one of the things you can do if someone starts a political conversation is divert it to a conversation that pertains to your business. So you can talk about, okay, with tariffs, you know, a lot of the news lately is about tariffs. Okay, what do we think the implications of this will be in our business? You can shift it to a conversation that's a little less hot because it's more focused on the implications in things that are appropriate workplace topics. So that's something I encourage people to do if they're at work and those types of issues come up, is to bring it to something that is a relevant topic for the workplace.
And Daphne, has this happened in your office?
It does feel like a bit of a rabbit hole. You know, the emotions are so combustible around this. I think everything Leanne said is completely applicable to the couple. I mean, if you are going to wade into these waters, it's really got to be about where are you really coming from? Like, where, you know, trying to understand the deeper emotions here. But this can be a hugely conflictual issue these days.
Well, let me pick up, I mean, beyond politics, but let me just pick up on that, Daphne, just the idea of living with someone who thinks differently about things that you think that you believe in. I mean, trying to figure out how to find, I guess, respect in that point of view and be able to live with difference. How important is that?
Well, living with difference is probably the most important thing, right? I mean, the most important thing is for me to be able to say to my partner, I can try to understand what you think and feel without that taking away from the validity of what I think and feel, right? That is the core capacity in any close relationship. You know, but sometimes these differences feel irreconcilable to people. In other words, I respect you, but I don't know if I can live with this, you know, and that can be an issue too.
Is there also, do you think, a tendency to try to make up too soon and to try to get whatever the conflict is? Daphne, I'll put it to you and then to you, Leanne, to sort of get beyond it so you don't have to deal with it anymore.
Absolutely.
Like a hot potato
and,
in a way?
Yes, and this is a huge thing in couples. I just saw a couple yesterday, you know, where they were disagreeing about whether they could, you know, leave town and leave their son alone at home. And one of them just kept trying to say, okay, let's do it your way, let's do it your way, in order to stop the conflict. That people can be enormously allergic to that. And what I try to do is say, keep the conversation going. Mm-hmm. Notice when you're retreating or giving up and shutting down, because that's going to come back to bite you. You know, if you can't advocate and you get overwhelmed or shut down, resentment will follow.
And that might not be a very pleasant getaway, right? If the idea is to get away from the kid, right?
That too.
Leanne, anything you want to? I mean, I'm sure this happens in the workplace too, which is there's a kind of avoidant tendency to say, let's not deal with this.
There are definitely people whose reaction is to drop eye contact, move their chair back from the table. And I love that Daphne used the word resentment to describe what happens if you drop the rope and leave it but don't resolve it. And there's a great Nelson Mandela quote that resentment is you swallowing poison, hoping the other person will die.
Oh, yikes.
And that's exactly what happens, is you start to poison yourself. You make your own work environment toxic by being bitter that this is the direction it has gone, or that your perspective wasn't heeded. But of course, it's a self-inflicted wound, because you are the one who didn't take the opportunity to share your differing perspective. So I really encourage teams to go through it to get to the other side of it, because otherwise we're into the passive aggressive behavior, or just the passive behavior that is resentment. And resentment really is toxic for us.
Daphne, I mean, it sounds like from what both you and Leanne are saying is that we could all use a refresher course on how to handle conflict.
Yeah, and I think it's a lifelong challenge. I really think it's important for everyone to be aware of the role of shame and shutting all this down, and being able to not essentially say, of course I don't have the whole truth. Of course I just have my own perspective. Of course I make mistakes. I mean, even in infant-parent relationships, the research shows that repair, that coming back and fixing things, that redoing things, that is what creates a secure, fulfilling bond in any relationship. So we all screw up to begin with. That's just definitional about being human. And if we can reframe human relationships in all their complexity in that way, I think it helps us out a lot.
How about, we're almost out of time here, and apologize?
Oh, huge, huge, huge. The problem with apology in couples is that people end up feeling that they have to apologize as the price of getting close again, and they have to apologize for too much. In other words, this whole thing was my fault in order for you to care about me again. And so we have to both be very generous with our own apologies, for our own taking responsibility for our own role, and not put the other person in the position of being all at fault for whatever happened. And that's the tricky thing. But
well,
the more you can apologize, the better.
Well, Daphne DeMarnef and Leanne Davey, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. We want to close things out with a clip from The Simpsons, Reverend Lovejoy leading a marriage counseling retreat.
Oh, three couples, our best turnout yet. Why don't we go around the room and everyone can introduce themselves and tell us a little bit about why they're here. John, Gloria?
My name's Gloria. I'm here because Johnny Boy hasn't been able to cut it man-wise for some time. Not that I'd want his odor of gin and sour defeat pressed against me.
That's enough, Gloria.
Thank you, Gloria. John, why don't you tell us a little about why you're here?
She never cooks. She keeps a filthy house and she talks profanely. She's the queen of the harpies.
No, I'm
queen
not.
Of the harpies.
No, I'm not.
Here's your crown, your majesty.
Now get away from
queen of the harpies.
Swine. To the right place. First, I want you to look into each other's eyes.
Your eyes. I've forgotten how beautiful they are.
Let's never fight again.
We were fools to argue.
Well, let's not talk about that.
Let's not talk at all.
Remember my saving your lives and bringing you happiness when we pass the collection plate next week.